You are listening to The Dope Sheet. Hello, Radio Free Brooklyn listeners. I'm your host, Willie Heartland, and my show is called The Dope Sheet, a talk show about animation. Today, I'm very honored to have as my guest, animation historian, professor, author, director, and of course, animator, the legendary patriarch of the New York animation scene, Howard Beckerman. And here is a brief list of the countless things he's done over the years in animation. For over 40 years, he contributed his expertise on the art of animation at the School of Visual Arts. There at SVA, he taught classes in animation, storyboarding, and the history of animation, and he also advised thesis students. Howard has drawn many of the most iconic animated characters of the 20th century, including Popeye, Heckle and Jekyll, and even Mighty Mouse at Terrytoons. Howard has worked at many of New York City's top studios of the past, including Terrytoons, Famous Studios, Paramount Pictures, Jumbo Pictures on Doug, where he directed one of the episodes, and many, many more. He is the author of The Animation, The Whole Story, where he offers a roadmap to the complex art of making an animated feature. Vivid sketches, screenshots, step-by-step illustrations show how to make a drawing come to life, create storyboard, use form and color, develop a soundtrack, edit, and more. Now, in its second edition, it is thoroughly updated to reflect the latest trends surrounding digital technology. Howard's book provides artists and aspiring filmmakers with everything they need to carve out their niche in today's quickly evolving animation industry. So I want to thank Howard for being here today on The Dope Sheet. Thank you, Howard.
Nice being here, Will.
Thank you. It's a real honor. My show is called The Dope Sheet, of course. And can you tell our listeners what a dope sheet is? It's also known as an exposure sheet. Did you use exposure sheets when you made your films?
Oh, yes. We always use exposure sheets. This is long before computers. Computers really do the exposure sheet for you sometimes. They keep track of your drawings. All your drawings are numbered and they're placed on a sheet so a camera operator can follow them when shooting it. But the numbers relate to the soundtrack, which is also indicated on the exposure sheet, right, or voice or music beats. And the animator applies his knowledge to making the drawings and then placing a appropriate number in the right place on the exposure sheet. Often we repeat actions or rearrange the drawings. Use the same drawings from the same numbers, but in different ways. So it was a very valuable sheet.
Yeah. Especially, you know, when you're working from a soundtrack to do the lip sync and to get the time everything out to a fraction of a second. Often you would work with a lockdown piece of sound and you'd have to figure out.
Exactly. And you had to really figure it out. But the wonderful thing about the exposure sheet was, for an experienced animator who's done a lot of things, you can put everything in the right place and not have to worry about how everything looks. You might want to see a pencil test, but you basically have it down. Whereas people sometimes just think you just throw things together and see what happens.
Right.
Very often they can pretty much judge what they're going to have.
Yeah. Yeah. They used to call it sort of editing in the camera, like animation. You don't edit afterwards. You do it before you start because it's so much labor. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I should explain to our listeners that Howard and I first met, I think, back in 1987 while we were animating kids' books for a producer named Alan Shalek. And we met through this gentleman named Bill Foch, who at the time had a small studio on West 46th Street. And I think there was like a little suite of studios and maybe you were on the same floor. I can't remember.
Yes, we're in the same group, same area.
Yeah. And that was kind of like part of the film industry. And on 45th, 46th Street, between 5th and 6th, that's where sort of a hotbed of activity, right? Where a lot of...
Yeah, there was one building at 45 West 45th Street where they had a lot of little studios, a camera service, a lab, a sound recording studio, everything. And I always said, I can make a whole film here on a rainy day without getting wet. You did a whole thing in that building.
Yeah, I remember I used to edit my children's books for Shalik at a place called Ross Gaffney.
Yes.
And it was like $50 a day. And I'd go in, I'd rent one of the 16 millimeter Steenbeck flatbeds, and I'd cut together the work print, I guess. And then I gave it to a negative cutter, and then I transferred it to video or something. And that's how it was done before computers, you know.
No, we were always going over to the lab, picking up the developed prints and redoing things sometimes and going back to the lab. You know, that was the way it was done.
Yeah. You had to wait overnight and you pick it up and it was go to Duard or TVC or one of those labs and,
Today, you know, you can probably do a change, a correction, about an hour and a half on a computer. In those days, it took 2 or 3 days. You had to reanimate something.
Oh, God.
Go to the lab and pick it up. And, yeah. It took at least 3 days.
Yeah, I would lose my shirt on revisions. You'd be like, oh, you know, I shoot on an Oxbury, there'd be a hair in the gate or something, or scratches on the film stock. And I'd be like, oh, my God, I have to go back and reshoot like hours and hours of children's books, you know. It's like it was terrible. I don't miss those days at all. Where did you? I used to use a Oxbury. It was Gary Becker. I used to rent his Oxbury. Which Oxbury did you use?
Well, I worked with all that. I worked with Gary, and I worked at the time. I probably met you. I was shooting with another fellow from Maverick Studio. But we used everybody. There were some very good ones. I can't think of all the names right now.
Yeah, there was Dan Esterman, I think, was the
ink. Yeah, Esterman.
Yeah.
Well, George was a very good cameraman.
Right. Yeah. And it was expensive. Yeah, it was. I sort of caught the tail end of the, you know, working on shooting on film when I got to New York in 84. Yeah, I don't miss that. But so let's back up a bit and go to the very beginning. At what point did you decide to become an animator? Was this when you were in high school or?
Maybe before. Yeah. I seem to always be a cartoonist since I was like 5 years old. And I think a lot of cartoonists I've met also talk about that. And I think part of it is we saw comic strips and it was our first exposure to any kind of art form. Was in the newspapers and later comic books. So we were inspired to do exactly the same thing. Mm-hmm. When I was about 9, that my sister, who was older than I was, took me to see Disney's Pinocchio. Mm. I had already seen Snow White and Mickey Mouse, of course, but when I saw Pinocchio, that really wowed me. To me, it was like some kid seeing a computer animation feature today. It sort of glowed and glistened and sparkled. And when I came home, I said to myself, I said, that's what I want to do. Of course, I didn't know how they did it. So I spent most of my years, like a teenage years, trying to find out how it was done by reading whatever I could. And there was very few books on animation, maybe 1.5 books.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, I was interviewing Jerry Beck and we were talking about the Christopher Finch book, The Art of Disney. And that was like the first time you saw the background paintings for more than a fraction of a second. They were in that book.
Yeah.
Sort of. And then you started to see all the storyboards and the pre-production art. And it started to crystallize in my head like, oh, wow.
Yeah. And most of the information I got was, believe it or not, from magazines like Popular Science, Popular Mechanics, because they're always doing articles about secrets of the movie makers. And that included animation.
Yeah,
but all the other articles that you would see would be publicity for a Disney film and very redundant stuff. But here's where I picked up a little bit. So when I actually started working in the business, I knew what was going on in the studio. I still had a lot to learn, but I knew what they were doing. the process, you know.
Yeah, right. And you got your first job at Terry Tunes, right? That was your first.
Right. It was right out of high school. I was 18 years old.
Wow. And so did you go to art school or not? You went.
Yeah, well, the high school, I went to the High School of Industrial Art, which is now the School of Art and Design.
Right.
And I really enjoyed it because we had all these art classes along with the other academic thing. And I really learned what I had to learn. And that was how I got the job, because the school had an advisory board, including artists or photographers, painters, and cartoonists. And Paul Terry was one of the guy for animation. So they looked at our portfolios when we were ready to graduate. And my art teacher, an illustration and cartooning teacher, Ben Clements, set up an appointment with me with Paul Terry up in New Rochelle. And I didn't know where New Rochelle was. So I had a little funny story about getting there and getting home. But I went up there and he interviewed me. And I got the job and started the next day.
Yeah. I saw the interview you did with this young man. You told the story about going up to New Rochelle and you only had about 25 cents in your pocket.
I had a dime.
A dime, yeah.
And I didn't really know how to get home. And I didn't want to ask anybody up there for money. I thought that would be a wrong way to start my career.
Right.
I was 18, so I didn't think about it very much. I stepped out on the sidewalk. I realized I only had a dime in my pocket. How am I going to get home? And the I got on a bus and said to Bronxville. And I had my sister lived in the Bronx.
Yeah.
So I figured I'll try this, see what, maybe that's near the Bronx.
Right.
I got on the bus, and when it pulled into Bronxville, then I knew I was lost. I didn't know where I was. And I approached the bus driver, and he flipped me a quarter. And I not only established myself in the animation business, I established panhandling.
Panhandling up there in New Rochelle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was able to get a bus to the Bronx and walk over to my sister's house and then back on the subway because I lived in Brooklyn.
Yeah, what part of Brooklyn did you grow up in?
Flatbush, yeah.
Yeah, my father grew up in Flatbush. My father graduated from Erasmus High School.
Yeah, that was right near me. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. He was born in 1919, and so he's no longer living. But anyway, that was a very famous high school, right? So do you remember the first assignment that you got at Terry Tunes? Sometimes people remember that first thing they were asked to do.
Well, yeah, I was painting cells when I started. And my first mistake that I made, I was confused between the color white and the color one gray. If you put it next to each other, you could see the difference.
Right.
But if they're not next to each other, you could just as easily put your brush in the gray, because it looked very white.
Right.
And that's when I learned the very first thing about you got to be careful with these things. And
yeah.
So luckily I didn't do a lot of cells that way. I kind of, but yeah. I never forgot that. That was the first thing. And the character was a goat, and the goat was eating cans and stuff.
Oh.
And,
wow.
It reminded me of Bach Beer, because at that time, it was right a few years after World War II, and the big thing was, the advertising was, beer and cans are back. they had a goat as a character in the advertisement, and we have a goat in this movie, mm-hmm. eating cans. So I always connected it with Bach Beer. They always showed a goat for some reason.
Wow. So that was the late 1940s when you started working, like 1948 or so at Terry Tunes.
Yeah.
Wow. And were you working, was Gene Deitch there at the time?
No, I didn't know Deitch. Deitch was he might have been California or Detroit at that time. Mm-hmm. Because all that UPA stuff and everything was out in Hollywood. They weren't in New York yet.
Yeah.
But I did, on lunch hours, I'd sometimes walk over to the library in New Rochelle, and I found a business magazine for film and show business, and it mentioned UPA. That was my first notice of that studio. And they said they might be opening an office in New York City. I'm very excited about that because I had seen some of their stuff. And I was really interested in the new style and design.
Yeah. Yeah. Some of the work you've done, the films that I saw that you did for Seamus, have a UPA style to them.
Yeah, he was very much interested in keeping that style active.
Right, right. Interesting. What was Paul Terry like to work with?
Paul Terry, when he hired me, he was a very fatherly guy. Mm-hmm. But he ran it like a schoolmaster in some ways. Like two guys got into a fight, two animators got into a fist fight one day because one wanted the window open and the other one, they wanted the window closed. Mm-hmm. Came out of his office and said, "You're like a couple of kids, get back to your desks." He was more like that.
Yeah.
He was, everybody, there's one thing I got to tell you about him. People always refer to him as being very tight with money. And he probably was, because that was his business. He was really an independent producer.
Right.
He wasn't doing stuff like Disney where you're making a lot of money on toys and all that kind of thing. So
right.
He hadn't really worked close to the vest. But one thing I noticed, when I got to that studio, the first studio, it was 1949. He had three African-American artists working there.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
He had one woman animator, and other studios didn't have that yet.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't have that. That was not necessarily something they would do. They didn't think these people could work on these things. But he was very good with that.
Wow. So he was way ahead of his time. Was that woman animator, was that Lillian Friedman?
No. She was at Fleischer Studios.
Yeah.
And by that time, she was already retired.
Yeah.
She was living upstate New York and she was raising a family. But no, one of the reasons he might have had all these different people is there was a union in animation in New York. They were trying to really get started. And he had the union in his office, but he didn't sign a new contract. And he said, "I'm not going to sign a contract." And so a lot of people went on strike. And then he closed down the studio for a few months.
Mm-hmm.
He reopened. He needed people because the people who were on strike refused to go back. They went to other studios.
Mm.
So he had to hire whoever was available. And so he hired talented people, no matter where they were.
Yeah.
I was impressed with that. Yeah.
And which cartoons did you work on? Was it Mighty Mouse or what did you?
Mighty Mouse, Heckle and Jekyll. They had another character called Roquefort. They just created it around the time I was there.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened was there was a class in the evening suddenly at CCNY, City College up in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
Going to have a night class in animation. So I enrolled in that because now I was inking and I was getting ready to do in-betweens.
Mm-hmm.
This over a period of months, And I went to the class and I was sort of discovered there by the teacher who became my mentor. It was Irving Spector. And he worked for famous studios. He was a story man and an animator, very talented guy. I always wanted to be like him, do storyboards, do animation. He was drawing comic strips, comic books, every kind of thing. And he got me a job at famous studios. I got a raise and I went right into in-betweening.
Wow.
So I moved from Mighty Mouse to Popeye, Casper the Ghost, and those characters.
Oh, and that was in the early 50s or?
Early 50s, yes.
Interesting. Wow. And that was the famous studios that came about after the Paramount pulled the plug on the Fleischer brothers down in.
Exactly. One of the things about the studio was Terrytoons had a plan where they spent only 2 weeks in each department, storyboard, layout, animation, painting, backgrounds, whatever. Everything took 2 weeks. They rushed the films out. The place like famous studios, they had a tradition of more accurate and finite animation. And I really wanted to get involved with that.
Yeah.
So it was an advance for me in many ways.
Hmm. And that was on West 45th Street, right?
Yeah, they were at 25 West 45th Street.
25, wow. Yeah, I worked at a studio called Charlex that was on 2 West 45th Street.
Yes. I remember that.
For my first year in New York, yeah. but I won't go into that. That was quite interesting. Yeah. So in the early 50s, that was during the advent of television.
Yes.
So there must have been a lot of work doing animating TV commercials at that.
Well, that was just starting. Just before I left Terrytoons, they did two television commercials. They did one for a beer in Philadelphia and one for a bread in New Rochelle or in Westchester. Mm-hmm. A bread commercial. And I got to Paramount's famous studio. Mm-hmm. They also did two commercials. And so that was just beginning. And what happened with me there was I got drafted into the service. Mm. I left there because I was sent to Korea.
Oh.
And when I came back in a couple of years, things had changed. TV commercials were really big. And when I came back, went right into television commercials, working at studios. Little studios had sprung up, mostly run by former animators and producers. And so that really, so for the next 35 years, I was doing commercials and other kind of films.
Yeah, working at, you didn't start your own studio right away. So you worked at small studios in Midtown working on these commercials.
That took me a while because initially, you know, to open a studio, you had to have a camera, you had to have an editing department, you had to have all that stuff. But what happened later in the 1970s, all of that changed. A lot of the small studios either went out of business or they broke up, the partnerships broke up, and a lot of the artists were kicked out or sent out, you know, to be on their own. So you got film editors open their own company. Camera services opened up their own place. Some women were doing ink and paint in their own little offices. So when I started my studio, I could not didn't have to have all those departments. I could use them. That's why I said, like in that building, these little departments already set up, I can just contract them to do the finishing or whatever I had to have done.
Yeah.
And freelance animators could be working at home. And so it was possible to get a lot of stuff done because I did a lot of the work myself. My wife was with me and she was a very good inker, opaquer.
Interesting, huh? So let's see, did you ever work for John Hubley for the Storyboard Inc. or?
No, I knew John Hubley. I never worked for him. He was always in town, and I always admired him because he was ahead of everybody in his ideas. I could see the rest of the producers doing commercials were very practical. All they saw was, you know, if they put an ad in a magazine, they wonder why the phone didn't ring. He had ideas that he'd just go to an agency and he'd come up with his own idea for a commercial and they'd be happy to have it, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There's a real, it's on YouTube, A Smattering of Spots. It's the Hubley's demo reel. And I think maybe Tommy Jose Stathis uploaded it. I don't know, but it's amazing. I just love those old.
And he loved jazz. He liked to use jazz. And he's very much into looser styles of work. Plus, he worked at UPA. He was one of the founders of UPA.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. And then he got blacklisted. So he had UPA, and they took his name off the credits. And then he was forced to go into TV commercials where there are no credits, right?
But it was okay because when he came to New York, he didn't have any problems. There was sort of, I guess that whole blacklist was sort of slightly winding down. But he was a worthwhile guy for them to have. He did the Maypole commercial, among many others, which was very popular.
Yeah.
And he even used it in Iron Giant, the movie they show.
Right.
Takes place in the 1950s, yeah.
Huh. In the 1960s, you were hired by Seamus Culhane, right, to work for him?
Yeah. I had worked with Seamus just before I went into the service. What happened was I got drafted when I was at Famous Studios, and they made me a little send-off party. Mm-hmm. But when I got that same week, I got a letter from the government saying my induction was being held up indefinitely. So I decided to go out and see what the commercial business was like. I got a job with Chambers. And then, of course, at the job ended, I was let go. And the very next day, I got a letter from the government saying I had a report. So I got a job immediately with Uncle Sam. And while I was away, UPA established a studio in New York. Mm-hmm. And there's a guy named Abe Liss was the director. And he went on to another studio, Transfilm. Hmm. And Gene Deitch was put in. Hmm. He was there. And I got hired within a few months of being out of the Army. I got hired to go to UPA. I was there for 3 or 4 years. It was a very creative place. And I really enjoyed that.
That was the UPA in New York City.
Yes, right. We were there for commercials and sort of, industrial films and that kind of thing.
Right. That's interesting. Yeah. Who were some of the principal people at the New York UPA studio?
Like, well, you had Brim Natwick, who had created Betty Boop years before, and he did most of the animation for the lead character in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
Right.
He worked everywhere, and he was working there, and he worked on some of UPA's Academy Award films. Mm-hmm. And they had Jack Schnark, who was another great animator. A lot of these guys were from the West Coast. Mm-hmm. And Lou Gagne, like that, he came originally from Warner Brothers, and he did a lot of commercials in the city. So at that time, I was meeting guys from the West Coast, along with guys from the East Coast, way back to the Fleischer, and then way back to, in fact, when I went to Chambers the first time, I was sitting two seats away from, he worked on Felix the Cat in the old days. It was Kanata, George Kanata Sr. And he was animating the commercial for Chambers. But then in the 1960s, Paramount redid their studio. They stopped calling it Famous Studios by then. They called it Paramount Cartoons. Mm-hmm. And, they moved to another building. And Chambers was put in charge of that unit. And I went up to see him, showed him my stuff, and I hadn't seen him in many years. Mm-hmm. I got hired, and I had a storyboard I had worked on, and he bought that.
Wow.
So I not only did the storyboard, I did the animation on a film originally called The Vacation, but Paramount put out a live action film called The Trip. So they decided to call this The Trip also. And The Trip in their film was about being on drugs, I think. But my trip was about a guy going on vacation. And
So I
animated that. And next thing I was involved with all the other stuff.
Yeah, I watched it last night. I loved it. The Trip from 1967. You wrote, directed it. You co-designed it. And it's amazing. It's done in this sort of Zagreb UPA style.
Yeah.
There's no dialogue. And it's sort of, I don't want to give it away, but it's about a guy who wants to go on a vacation, and then things kind of sort of a Murphy's Law of things that happen, and then
everything goes wrong. Yeah.
It was really funny. I love the opening shot. It's very flat of the city. It's like a matrix of cars, and so
a lot of work figuring that out with all the pens and the long before the computer. Everything was done by pencil, with pencil on paper, and you figured everything out, cutting paper and pasting things up and all that.
Yeah. It's interesting, Seamus, because he worked on Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. I know he did the scene where the dwarfs are walking across the lawn.
Yeah, he spent a lot of time on that.
Yeah.
6 months on that. There's an anecdote about that scene with the dwarfs walking across the log. He had a crew working on it with him, and each dwarf had to walk slightly differently because of personality.
Right.
It was really a lot of tough work. But what happened was they really didn't allow smoking in the studios because the cells and the film were very highly inflammable. But guys would smoke and get away with it. And sometimes they just throw the butt in the wastebasket. Well, one guy did that, but the butt was still lit. And it suddenly flamed. And all of the drawings were lying on the shelves above that basket, and the ends of the drawings were hanging off the shelf, and it singed them all on the edges. That spent a lot of time re-pegging everything.
Oh,
scene. So that was these are the hazards of doing animation.
Yeah. It's now that everything, I mean, there's certain problems. You know, if you don't have your work backed up, the computer can, crash and you can lose all your work. But really, digital is really
safe. One of the things I found a lot of students can't do anymore, at least they're afraid to do it, is flip their drawings.
Yeah.
But the animators, before they made a pencil test,
right,
flip the drawings to see how the action looked. You just pick the whole pack and flip it like you're flipping a notebook or something. And I had found out the last few years of teaching, nobody knew what that was anymore.
Yeah, because you don't do it anymore. You just hit, if you're on
play,
you do RAM preview or whatever, and you see it.
Some students, they do four drawings and push that thing and then sit and stare at the four drawings moving all day long.
Yeah, it's a new world.
I had to do 200 drawings and flip them and catch all their mistakes and everything like that.
So, right.
But I think also it taught you a lot. You really had it in your hands, like it wasn't like something you couldn't touch on a TV screen or a computer screen. But there's always learning. So that was the tradition.
Huh. So what year did you open your own studio? Was that in the 70s or the...
In the 1970s. What happened was when I went to that class way years back at CCNY, there was a couple of guys I met there who were already going to NYU. There were very few film courses. Nobody was really teaching animation. Mm-hmm. But they were very much involved in film. And they came here to learn other things at night. And they wanted to take animation because they wanted to learn about that. So one of the guys is Bob Braverman. When he went into business, he became a film editor and a producer and an editor and everything, a filmmaker. And so he used to call me to do animation for some of his films. And one day I was walking down the street in May of 1970, I remember. And I was at a place where they were going to lay us off again in about 2 days. And it was a nice sunny day. I'm walking along. All of a sudden, he comes up beside me, and I hadn't seen him in about a year. And he said that he's now the head of Xerox Films.
Oh.
Big companies like Xerox, this is a little before the computer got into this thing, really. The companies were going into educational materials. They had teaching machines and all kinds of tricky things like that. And he set up their film company. So they made him the head of it and the director of it. And they were making films for children, showing classes, educational stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He needed three-minute animated films to be used in sort of little machines that we're using for kids to look at little things they could run over and over again. He said, "You'd like to do that, wouldn't you?" I said, "Sure." Went home and started in my basement in my house.
Mm-hmm.
And about a month, I see all the drawings piling up. I went out and got space in Manhattan, and I put a phone on a wall, and that was the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's over 50 years ago now. I started my studio, and that lasted for over 25 years.
Wow.
Other people were going into their own places. And so the other thing that opened up was Sesame Street. That was a boon to all of us because they just started.
Yeah,
the guys to do animation, like little commercials for the letter B and the number four.
Yeah,
we were doing that. All the studios were, and that really came in just at the right moment for me.
Yeah, like 1969, 70. That was around the time I was born in 62, and I remember when Sesame Street came on TV, and the animation was just amazing. It was some of the first time I saw kind of independent animation.
Yeah. Yeah, they liked that. They were going to guys who weren't going to charge them a lot of money.
The difference
between doing a commercial and an educational film was always a tremendous gulf between the two. But it was fine, especially for me just starting out. Mm-hmm. I went from one thing to the next. And so it worked out very well that way. So we all did commercials and that type of thing.
Right. But yeah, those were wonderful. It's too bad now, Sesame Street, they don't work with independent animators anymore.
No.
They're doing it in-house at some studio where they're doing all the Sesame Street spots.
Yeah.
All like animated Muppet characters.
That's what happens. Always think everything goes through a nice when it starts out, it's a little rough and
yeah,
a little more casual, and they're trying to get it done, but they're learning all about it. And then it becomes, especially when the computers came in, you know, anybody can do a film now. An 8-year-old can make an animated film.
Right.
May not be great, but at least he can do it because he can pull down the sound effects and music.
And when did you start teaching at SVA in the 1970s? Or
No, I started teaching at initially in 1971 at the Phoenix School of Design.
Oh.
They had a cartooning teacher there who left in the middle of the class, middle of the semester, because her mother was sick in California, but she never came back. So they asked me to come in and take over the class. And I was busy with my new studio, and I didn't really want to get diverted from that. So I first turned it down, and I had nothing against teaching, but I just figured I didn't want to be taken away from it. But the guy that asked me to do it said, why don't you just go in and do it? So I said, I'll do it for 2 weeks, and I'll get you somebody else. Well, that never happened. They gave me 2 classes in a few months, and then I got a call from Parsons School of Design. They wanted someone to come in the evening. The thing about both of these schools, they never had any animation equipment when they called me in. I had to make a whole thing up on my own. I brought in my own 16mm camera and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then finally, I got a call from SBA because I had a friend, Gil Moret, was working there, teaching there, and they were beefing up the department. They were just enlarging their animation department.
Mm-hmm.
He mentioned me, and I got hired to do to teach animation drawing.
Mm.
And then John Culhane, who was a sort of relative maybe to Seamus Culhane.
Oh, yeah, I met him once. Yeah, right.
Yeah, and he was a writer. He worked for Newsweek, but he loved animation and was working. And he had interviewed everybody in Hollywood about animation and guys in New York. So he created the history of animation class, the first history animation class with credit in the whole world, probably.
Wow.
He did that. But then about a year and a half later, he got stuck working on a script in London, and he couldn't come back. And they gave the class to me.
Wow.
And I really didn't have more than 2 days to get it started. So I had to pull all our stuff together, and I went and did it. 25 years into doing that class, Culhane wrote a book about Aladdin, Disney's Aladdin. He wrote the book for the Disney.
Oh, the Art of Disney, yeah.
So
yeah.
I called him up and I said, it's 25 years since I took over the class and you started. Why don't you come in? I'll rent the film, Aladdin. You show them your book and we'll talk, you know. And he did. We showed the film. And afterwards, I went out for a cup of coffee. And I said, John, why couldn't you come back to school? He said, I was working with Richard Williams on The Thief and the Cobbler.
Hmm.
And he decided all of a sudden, let's get Vincent Price to be the voice of the villain.
Oh,
didn't
wow.
know Vincent Price and didn't even know how to get in touch with him.
Mm-hmm.
He finally got in touch with his agent. He got his phone number in California. They called him up and they asked him if he could be the voice. He said, yes. But at the time, he was engaged to a young woman, British actress in London. So he said, if I can spend 2 weeks with my fiance, I'll do the voice after that.
Mm.
Sure, crazy. So they hung up, and then they were saying, we got Vincent Price, we got this, you know. And then all of a sudden, they realized they had no dialogue for him.
Oh.
Because the way they were doing the film, they were just creating things as they went along.
Right.
So Culhane had to stay there and write dialogue when Vincent Price came in the next week, finally, like to voice it. So that's how I got the history of animation, which I did for 47 years.
That's a great story. Oh, my God. Yeah, that happened to me at CUNY. Suddenly somebody, this woman who was teaching history of animation at one of the CUNY colleges, got pregnant, and she never told the school. And then they called me up a week before the semester. Can you teach history of animation? I had to quickly run out and buy the Donald Crafton book and cram on the history. And I was always 1 week ahead, you know, like keeping my head above water, trying to prepare for each lecture. And anyway, but that's very interesting. Okay, let me pause for a moment and remind listeners that they are listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. Radio Free Brooklyn is a 501c3 nonprofit. Donate at radiofreebrooklyn.org/donate. We also have iPhone and Android mobile apps where you can listen along as well. And now a word from our sponsor.
You worked too hard, you ate too much, the cheesecake made you greedy. Let your aching head and stomach hear this message from old Speedy. Alka-Seltzer, plop, plop, fizz, fizz. Oh, what a relief it is. Plop, plop, fizz, fizz. Oh, what a relief it is. Ah, those Speedy Alka-Seltzer bubbles burst into action to relieve your upset stomach and aching head fast. It was only as directed. Oh, what a relief it is. What a relief.
And we are back. We are talking to the legendary Howard Beckerman. Okay, I'm going to, since you have worked with some of the industry's legendary animators, I'm going to throw a few names out there and get your response to some of these people. See what you come up with. Jim Tyer.
Oh yeah. He was my first hero. And the first scene I ever in between was a very small Jim Tyer scene, the Mighty Mouse.
Yeah.
Yeah, he had his own style and he worked everywhere and he'd been around a long time.
Uh-huh.
And everybody just liked to watch him because he animated straight ahead very often.
Right.
And he had his very style where he did everything in circles and had lots of squash and stretch and characters would zip out of the screen. And he got in trouble a few times, like because he would lose the character. But everybody always admired him because that was fun. He gave it the kind of fun thing that I'm glad he could draw the character accurately, but he also could take and distort it and give it a little excitement to it. So he was my first animated hero.
Yes, you got to work with him. And he was known for his really, like his rubbery kind of double takes where the character would almost turn into an Picasso painting. It would abstract. And
I remember one thing, he also would go in and help out in the story department. And he did a storyboard with a very funny frame. There was a thing where they had a cat and mouse thing like Tom and Jerry also. And the mouse jumps into a toaster. And then the cat puts his hand in the toaster and then he brings it out. It looks like his hand looks like a piece of bread toasted.
Right.
I remember the funny that the drawing was so funny. Just the drawing was funny. You could laugh at the drawing of that hand and the guy looking at it. When they animated it, this is where Terry would get in trouble sometimes. Disney would have worked on it. They would have spent more money on that scene.
Mm-hmm.
It came out, it wasn't as funny in the animation because the timing had to be special. That was moving, not just a still.
Right.
So the timing had to be on longer with something different about it. I noticed that the still drawing was funnier than the animation in that instance.
Yeah. Huh. And he was also known as a prankster, right? Didn't he do a lot of practical jokes?
Yeah, he liked that. And I always mentioned that when it came time on the Christmas time, they had a little party and they had a grab bag and you got a number, and that name, and you went out and bought a little gift for somebody. And I never wanted to get anything stupid. I like to get something, even though it was going to be under a dollar, I like to get something that was usable, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like that. So what happened with Tyler was because he was always doing the pranks, the animators got hold of an old tire out of somebody's garage and they put a caricatured face in the front, you know, with a nose done with a carrot and brass to make a mustache or some kind of thing. And they called that Jim Tyer. And everybody laughed. I said, well, that's what you get for being a prankster. You don't get anything practical. You get a goofy joke, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a big laugh, yeah.
Huh. Wow. Well, he's a legend. I mean, I've heard, you know, animators like John Crisfalusi and all sorts of people, they talk about him.
Well, Crisfalusi always admired him, yeah.
Yeah, they really revere him. He's like, you know, so I'm surprised there hasn't been a book about him or, you know.
Well, that's true. But, you know, he was just a regular guy, had a family, had kids, One of the animators, young animators, they married his daughter.
Huh.
Yeah. I remember that. One of his daughters. And but he was a very nice guy, really.
Did you ever work with Ray Favada?
Yes, Ray was a very nice guy. And sad thing about him, he died prematurely. But he and I worked together. He was very nice. He was very talented. He very smart. Mm-hmm. He could play the piano and the organ. And he had a little small piano or organ in the office, and we sit down and play it. And I got him to teach. Well, I didn't get him to teach, but I was there when he started teaching at SBA for a while.
Mm-hmm. What about Fred McGubgub?
Fred and I met him right after I got out of the Army. He had been in the service also. And we ended up working at was Film Graphics. Mm. Also a studio. That was Lee Blair. A lot of guys from Disney and Warner Brothers working. That was really my first sort of Disney experience in animation. Mm-hmm. Working with these guys. So Don Towsley was the director there. And he did a lot of those. You look at the old model charts of Donald Duck and Mickey Mouse in the late 30s. He did those. He drew those.
Oh, he did? Fred McGovern?
And then he worked on Fantasia. And he worked on a lot of stuff. He did a lot of Donald Duck stuff earlier.
Wow.
He's a very precise animator. I got a very good experience out of that.
When I think of Fred McGubgub, I think of those commercials he did in the 70s that were really psychedelic. And
yeah, well, he really incorporated all that stuff in the early 70s. Mm-hmm. He really took off in a different direction.
Yeah.
He was very clever that way. He was doing paintings. Mm-hmm. He was really a fine artist. But he was also very, very, very courageous in what he did. He took chances with a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And it really helped change the viewpoint of the business.
I think I met him in passing once at Gary Becker's studio at the F-Stop studio once. I think he came in for some reason. I met him very quickly. But did you mention Lee Blair? Did I hear?
Yes.
Was it Lee Blair who was married to Mary Blair?
Yeah, that was his wife. She came up, I remember, one time. They lived out in Great Neck.
Oh.
And she was busy doing children's books and advertising stuff. And for Disney, she was freelancing. For Disney World, at that time it was Disneyland.
Yeah,
designs for them,
the murals and things. Yeah,
murals. And she had done a lot of stuff with her films.
Yeah, she was a concept artist at Disney.
Yeah. Right. And we all wanted to be like her because she had done some little golden books. And
right.
Really inspired a lot of us to the colors that she was using. We were really inspired by her work.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Wow. And what about Pablo Ferro? Did you know him?
No. Pablo, yeah, he was very good. He got in with McGub, and he started out as office boy at a studio called Tempo, which was a former Disney guy. Bill Tytler was a director there. He was one
Lou Schwartz, too, right?
That came later.
Yeah, right.
Lou Schwartz was an agency guy.
Oh.
Who went in with the government and Ferro. And then he moved up to become an animator. Together, he and McGovern figured out a technique that they use, hand-drawn technique, where they could finish animating a commercial in about 3 days.
Huh.
They had a very clever idea.
They do that?
They didn't do the color and all that, just the drawings, about 3 days.
Oh.
They worked out a system. I can't show you this on the radio, but that way, the character would squat, like bend his knees, and then move, and then do the same thing, move another direction. It was like they simplified the action and got rid of stuff that didn't matter. Like, you know, whether Disney would have the guy become the character and then, you know, putting on his overcoat and buttoning it. Well, forget that. They didn't do that.
Oh. So it was a very stylized, kind of limited animation.
Yeah, they stylized the animation. And they got away with it for a lot of commercials because very often a commercial was just a small segment within live action, basic, you know, commercial. And it looked funny.
Yeah.
And people liked it.
There was I think I met Pablo once. He came into F-Stop studio, and there was a cameraman working for Gary Becker named Wolfgang Pharaoh. And Gary told me that was Pablo's illegitimate son.
Have you?
Yeah.
He had about nine other siblings.
Oh.
Joe Pharaoh his brother was a cameraman, and he had the other people who were in animation married his sister or something, and they became part of the family. So he knew all, so that everybody was related.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that. I just remember I thought, really? And then Pablo doesn't talk to him, but he works for me. His name's Wolfie. And it was like, okay. And it was just something I remembered. I wanted to ask you about that. Yeah.
He was making a lot of money in the 50s because he was backing out so much stuff. In fact, a few of us were going to go to lunch with him, the restaurant was like two blocks away. He said, let's take a cab. So we all got in a cab and went two blocks.
Yeah.
He had his pockets were full of money.
Yeah, he was the legendary kind of film designer, title designer in the 50s and 60s.
Oh, yeah. No, he was also, like McGuff, he was also very clever, very courageous, and very creative.
Yeah, he was kind of like Saul Bass. They were all kind of in
the same page. And a lot of designers, who didn't work in animation, they all wanted to get into film. They saw Saul Bass and stuff that Pharaoh was doing.
Mm. And did you ever work with Jan Svoshak, who did?
Oh yeah, he was that famous when I got to Famous Studios, and he inherited the Hawaiian Punch commercials.
Right, Punchy. Yeah, yeah.
And that was designed by Tex Avery, I think.
Oh really? Oh,
so the original idea, and animated in Hollywood, but later on they were doing it in New York, and he got to do it because he did a very good, imitation of the original ones.
Right.
Very good with that.
What about Art Babbitt? Did you ever meet him?
Yeah, I met Art Babbitt a few times. In fact, when I was working at UPA, he was working for Hubley right across the street from us. I didn't know him then, but I met him a couple of times. He was the guy everybody knew. I heard about it, and he's the one who was very really affected animation and timing.
Yeah, there's this commercial he directed that he animated called Snowdrift that's on YouTube. It's for Snowdrift Margin or something, and it was all animated by Art Babbitt, and I think Bubbly directed him. It's just brilliant. Well, we're getting near the end of the interview. You're working on something called Ghost Empire, The Forgotten Story of Harvey Comics. Is that something that's in progress?
I keep hearing about it. I did an interview with them. I haven't heard the rest of that.
Yeah.
I see. Up with Tom. Yeah, they showed me a scene, but I don't know where they are with it.
Hmm. Okay. All right. That's interesting. Well, is there anything that are you working on any more books, or is there anything you want to plug before we say goodbye?
My book is getting to be old, but I don't know. I started a few books, but I'm at a point now where I'm retired and I just like drawing and doing my own things. And I realized that what I found out was that books are for students. They should get them and read them.
Yeah.
But I found a lot of teachers don't use them. Everybody who teaches art likes to feel they know how to teach this thing. And so they're not going to use someone else's book unless they grow up with it or somehow. But I think students should read the books because you find out about little things here and there. Every book has at least one difference in it.
Yeah.
The author has his own personality or her own personality, and that goes into the book. And you find out some fact that you never realized.
Right.
I can tell this one anecdote, though.
Yeah.
I always tell students that if you're going to school and you graduate and you go to an animation studio, the first 6 minutes in that studio, you'll learn more in that 6 minutes than you learn here in 4 years. Because you finally see what people do. And she does this, he does that. And then someone comes over to you and says, and sit down at your desk and says, could you do this little thing for us? And suddenly, all your big ideas, you've been involved in some little piece of something to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. I remember you say you learn a lot in the first 6 minutes at an animation studio. I remember when I worked on Beavis and Butthead, and Yvette Kaplan, one of your former students, came into my cubicle and she started acting out the scene. She became Beavis in the cubicle. She was like, now what would Beavis do if he was trying to open a pickle jar? How would he do it? And she started acting it out in front of me. And I thought she was crazy. And I thought, and then I learned, I thought, oh, that's the key. Like, if you're not sure how to draw a pose, you act it out in a mirror and then you figure out how to do it.
And she was terrific. She still is. She's a great. And she was a student. She worked with me for a while, and I worked for her.
Yeah.
But she's fantastic. And
yeah, she is. Yeah. I was lucky to have her. Yeah. I interviewed her for this radio show. You can listen to the interview later if you want. But had some of your other students. You taught. Did you have Tom Cito?
Tom Cito.
Yeah. Nancy Beeman.
Nancy Beeman.
Yeah.
She wasn't a student of mine, but she came up to the classes.
Yeah.
She went to school out at
CalArts.
She was in CalArts.
Yeah.
She really taught herself a lot on her own also.
Yeah, she's amazing. Yeah. Eric Goldberg.
Yeah, Eric Goldberg wasn't a student, but I met him. There was this production at Raggedy Ann in Manhattan, the same building I was in.
Yeah.
In my studio. And I used to bump into them. And went sometimes went to lunch with them. Goldberg. I used to see, what's his name? Dick Williams going up and down the elevator.
Yeah.
Heading into London or to LA. If I saw him going someplace, heading to an airport.
Yeah. His book, by the way, speaking of animation books, The Animator's Survival Kit, student. Yeah. If you don't have this book, I mean, that is the best book on classical Disney, you know.
Animation. Came out about time mine did. I felt mine was sort of a supplement to that because he didn't touch on a lot of things I touched on. So we have both books, you're okay.
Yeah, you cover all the bases with both books. We had when I was in school, the only book in the 70s that I could find was the Preston Blair book, which was okay, but it was a little.
Well, when that first came out, you know, the original one, it was a dollar. And that was the first time we ever saw a real animator do a real book on animation.
Yeah.
That was a milestone.
It really was. Yeah, the sequences from Fantasia with the crocodile and the hippo and all that stuff. And the stuff he did for Tex Avery of the Red Hot Riding Hood. You know, all that stuff was amazing to see it in a sequence. Okay, well, I think we are winding down here. We're nearing the end. Howard, this is just such an honor to interview you. I've been wanting to interview you since I started my radio show. And so I just want to thank you. Thank you for being a guest today. It was really
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Oh, good, good. I just want to remind listeners, The Dope Sheet is a weekly talk show about animation broadcast every Sunday at noon on Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm your host, Willie Hartland. And let's have a round of applause for Howard Beckerman. So then here I insert the sound effects of people clapping. You are listening to The Dope Sheet.